Hey everybody, welcome to Podcast Lost in Space, episode 22. More or less just a, we moved last week's episode to this week because we got a little crazy. But before I get started, I want to say that today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free Audible book, audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/pliss. With over 180,000 titles to choose from on your iPhone, iPad, Kindle, or MP3 player. And there'll be a little, we'll talk a little bit more about it midway. Cool. So, we're down a few, as you can see. I don't know what's up with Doc. Seneca's recovering from her master's, or her PhD stuff, interviews, and flying all over the country to go to the interviews.
Very cool.
We've got Alyssa. Ryan just woke up about 5 minutes ago when I called him, which I think has happened like 3 or 4 times before on the podcast. So he'll join us in a bit. And then joining us, too, we've got one of my... Actually, God, I've known you for a while now, but one of my friends, Emmett, who will talk about himself.
Should I talk about myself now?
Yeah. Who are you? Where do you come from? What planet?
Hello, my name is Emmett Scout. I am, I think you had my friend Cora Walker on the podcast a couple weeks ago. Cora and I are actually coworkers. We work together at the Digital Future Lab at University of Washington. I'm the lab's design lead, and I used to work there as an editor, and I moonlight as a fiction writer. And yeah, that's me.
Nifty.
And then everybody knows me. It's Alexander. This is all my thing. This can't work without me being here. So
this is true.
So then, as always, Alyssa, what have you been up to the last little while? You've missed a few.
Oh, yes, I've been really busy. I had a bunch of tests, but then I've been busy with a lot of Kappa Delta stuff, Girl Scout events, volunteering.
Cookies?
Lots of cookies. Yes. We did this thing called Cookie University, and we basically taught the Girl Scouts how to sell cookies and what all the cookies are, and so we did cookie tastings. So I ate a lot of Girl Scout cookies.
I volunteer for that?
No.
I want to volunteer for cookie tasting.
And then we're also, expanding our Greek system here, so we're getting a new sorority, and so I've been a part of going to the presentations for the new sororities and helping try and decide which one we actually want to come be a part of our community. I've been working. We did this thing called Freeze-a-thon with one of the fraternities, and we basically for 4 days straight, 24 hours, somebody's always outside on the corner of Loaf and Jug, which is like a gas station kind of thing, and we basically ask for money, and it goes to Nokomis Child Care Center, which helps underprivileged kids and gives scholarships so then they can go to daycare while their parents make money and work.
And she's in North Dakota.
Yeah, so, I'm in North Dakota, so it's freezing, so it's, really cool.
Oh, gosh.
So, yeah, we put on, I don't know, I think Allie and I had 5 layers of clothing on. And then, they raised about $15,000 for that, so that was really great.
That's pretty good.
I'm looking at my calendar, trying to figure
it's
out.
It's not balmy here, but it's not that cold.
Yeah, it's cold. And then we had a... person visit from National, so we had pledge class meeting with them and stuff like that. And then the cool thing.
Are you doing schoolwork as well?
Yeah. I got 49 out of 50 on my anthropology test.
Nice.
So that was good. And then we had a police officer get shot a couple weeks ago. Yeah, and
last week.
Yeah, last week? Was it last
week? Last week.
Yeah, I think so. And in a standoff with a domestic violence incident and stuff. So this past, or yesterday, I painted the window in honor of him because Kappa Delta, we have a window that faces the street. So I was busy doing that.
That was scary too because it's a small town. So it was, for a while, it's a small town compared to Bellevue or Redmond.
Yeah, yeah. A little too close to home.
It was a for a while it sounded like a university shooting until the news channels got everything short and sorted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which isn't fun to be like, my sister's at that university.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a little worrisome, but...
And it's Orion.
Yeah. And also, Newman's here. And then I'm also having a pizza party currently with my roommates, so I'll be eating pizza throughout this podcast.
Very good. I'm jealous.
Yeah.
There we go. Cool. So... We do a how was your week thing, which never makes sense when we have a guest on, but, you know, how have you been, Emmett?
Yeah, just sort of in general or just the week?
Yeah, just kind of in either way, pick your poison.
I'm sort of in the middle of an interesting quarter right now, and I think of it in quarters because I'm still in university. I'm taking this quarter off for mostly health reasons. I have acute tendonitis in both wrists, and I have since October or late September. So going on quite a while now, I think 5 months, and started physical therapy just in January for that, and pretty much it made schoolwork really hard last quarter, and so I decided to take the quarter off to recover, so I've been still working and having an unprecedented amount of time to devote to original projects, but I've also been having to dictate everything that I write, so it's been a time of experimenting with new technologies.
I'm super interested in how you're able to do that, because in my senior year, I got the brace on. I ended up with like micro tearing in my fingers. Not as bad as acute tendonitis, thankfully. But I had people like, you know, doctors being like, you need to stop typing.
Yeah.
And I was culture, literature, and the arts degree. And I'm like, I'm an anthropology degree.
Mm-hmm.
I literally can't do this.
And you take notes typing, too. So that's,
you do everything. Yeah. I mean, you have to communicate with people. And I was taking, last quarter, I was taking... an interactive media design class, which required, you know, a lot of visual drafting of prototypes. I was taking a computer science class that involved huge amounts of typing, and that I actually wound up having to dictate to other people because the dictation software I use would not integrate with the code software.
Oh, there's an argument. Yeah,
that would make sense.
Yeah, so I wound up having to verbally dictate my exams to like helpers, and that was fun.
That sounds miserable.
It was great.
You got good at that kind of coding. Hey Ryan, I found a million dollar idea.
Dictation software for computer science.
Yeah, for computer science majors.
It would be great because it was miserable. It was an awesome class. I loved it. And I'm excited to take the second one in the sequence, but I'm waiting until I can use my hands again.
Nobody who listens steal that. I want that, because I actually think that would be a really good idea.
Dude, it would be awesome. And the software is actually pretty good as far as general dictation. I use Dragon, naturally speaking, and it's pretty solid. I mean, there's a lot of, it can't do great, but it can do almost everything decently, which is enough to keep me from hurting myself. By trying to use my wrists when I shouldn't, because official word of the doctor is just stop. Stop everything. Don't use them for stuff.
Isn't that great when the doctors are like, look, the only answer is to literally stop everything you do.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, but...
Yeah.
But what do I do?
What do I do then? And I can't, like, I can't write by hand. No. I can't do, you know... a lot of day-to-day tasks. So it's kind of like, I'm glad I have dictation software so I can at least do writing.
Can you open jars?
No, definitely not.
Bad day. No pickles for you.
No. Luckily, I have some really cool roommates who have been very kind because I also can't clean very well. Like, I can't do dishes. I can't do any of these motions. I can't lift a lot of stuff.
You've got your own braces?
Hmm?
Did you get braces ever?
No, I don't have braces. Those, according to my doctor, wouldn't have actually helped. They would have prevented me from injuring myself more, but yeah. They won't actually help it get any better.
Well, that's kind of where I was like, they were like, look, put this on when it starts hurting, and then, like, you can't type, you have to do this now.
Yeah.
And they're like, but you know what? Your wrist isn't moving.
Yeah. I think the particular, because it's actually not my wrists, I keep forgetting, because I thought it was. It's actually my elbows.
Ooh.
And so I think the wrist brace that I was wearing wasn't actually stopping me from doing stuff that it was putting strain on my elbow. It may even have been, like, redistributing.
It's backwards into it.
Tension, yeah.
So that's awful.
Yeah. I have tennis elbow, technically.
Man, the human body sucks.
I know.
There are a few things, like, I don't want to break, and it's anything in your mouth, because then, like, that ruins it. And then anything in your hands, especially for writers and, like, the techies. We're like, those are the worst injury. I don't care if my foot gets broken. Like, that sucks. It's a pain in the ass to move around. But I don't really need to move around that much.
I wonder if I can get workers' comp if I were to break a finger. Something I should look into.
Well, I know there are voice actors getting stunt pay for having to, like, yell and shout.
It makes sense. I mean,
yeah.
You hurt yourself doing that.
We completely derailed. Ryan, how have you been?
Good.
You just woke up. Where have you been?
Yeah. Well, I've had a game at 8 a.m., so I came back and I was taking a nap, and that's when you called. Yeah, not much. I had my birthday on Thursday.
Happy birthday.
How old are you now?
23.
Holy crap, you're old.
He's a little older than me.
Alex, we're all growing up, and it's gross, and I don't want to be an adult.
That's why this exists.
I know. I can't believe you guys are going to be 23. Well, Newman is now, but...
So I actually do have a bit of a story to go along with that. So I went out with some friends down here, and
you don't have friends.
I had quite a few drinks, but, you know, it was my birthday, and I got a free card to, like, not show up to work on Friday. But because I'm also looking for a new job, I had a couple interviews. So Friday, I get a phone call at about 11 a.m. while I'm still recovering from the night before, and I ignore it the first time. I'm like, it's probably some recruiter. I'll just let it go to voicemail and call them on Monday. Well, it turns out they called again right away. I'm like, crap, this is important. I had a technical phone interview, which I thought was next Friday. My email said next Friday. I had a technical interview, still really, really drunk from the night before for a job that I really want. So that was interesting.
So how'd it go?
Yeah, how'd you do?
I apologized to him right away and was like, I'm sorry. Like, I thought my email said next week. I called in sick to work today, and I just woke up, so I apologize if I'm a bit out of myself trying to, not seem. Because if I knew it was the 19th, I wouldn't have had as many drinks as I had before.
Mm-hmm.
And I double and triple checked the email afterwards, and it definitely said the 26th. So
sucks.
I am not the one at fault here. But I think I did okay. I think I remember him saying they're going to invite me for an on-site interview, which is great. My recruiter is kind of – I was still really drunk. My recruiter is kind of flaky. So it's kind of hard to get in contact with her, and she didn't email me Friday, but I feel like it went well, especially for the state of mind that I was in at the time. But yeah,
that's good.
Isn't this the second time you've been woken up by an interview?
Yeah, I feel like I remember one other time too.
I feel like we need to have you have, like, a personal secretary or something to keep track of your life, because you just sleep a lot.
I do sleep a lot. I'm tired. Sleep well. I have sleeping problems.
Yeah.
Me too.
Cool.
I'd rather stay up and sleep in than go to bed early and wake up early, but that doesn't really work once you get a career.
Yeah.
And I'm still trying to...
Yeah. Unless you get a later evening career. but you know.
Or freelance.
Night. Or freelance.
Although, freelance would be nice.
Our mutual freelance friend Kizzy was supposed to be here, and she's drowning because of freelance.
Yeah, but I mean, you can at least schedule it how you want. Like my roommate also does freelance, not the one you know, different roommate, as an editor, and I usually see her go to bed in the 3 to 5 a.m. range.
Her brain's more awake.
Yeah.
The perfect time would be like, I don't know, I go to bed at 2 and I wake up around like 11 or 12 and then just work for 8 hours and get off work at like 9 p.m. That'd be perfect for me, but that doesn't work.
That's not how the world works, though.
Well, it could be if you freelance, like we were saying. You just pretend you're in a different time zone to all your clients.
Freelance is the dream.
Freelance is also a nightmare because you're in charge of being an adult yourself. See, you have somebody else being an adult reminding you.
My like different career paths that I'm kind of curious in taking are all like odd hours and weekends and nights and stuff. So my dream would be to have a 9-to-5, but that's probably not going to happen.
Yeah, my dream right now is to find a way that I can immediately go freelance after graduation as a writer, which would be really exciting. So I'm like, I'm super pumped about the idea of freelance right now, but yeah.
I'm amazed at all of, I have a few, you know, more than a few artist friends going freelance, and it's like every time I'm like, wow, I can't imagine it.
I've hit a point where I'm kind of using this last year of school.
Her internet's. Keep going. Oh, yeah.
Okay. I'm kind of trying to use this last year of school, because I'm probably graduating in December, to see how much work I can get out before I am unleashed into the world and see how much money I could potentially make on that. I've heard encouraging figures in my genre, so I don't know. Yeah. We'll see.
I've heard some scary things from like games journalist side of it, which is where people can, you know, it's like they're like, no, I'm living on food stamps and barely even that, and I'm like, great, not my field ever.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we got all career talky.
Yeah, I'm looking into genre fiction, which at least for larger releases comes with royalties. Mm-hmm. So it is kind of a like, you know, you start off with not much, but
and it kind of you build up,
which is why I'm trying to start now. And ideally probably would have started years ago, but didn't have the time and wasn't a good enough writer.
Yeah. On a similar vein, I had an interview on Friday for a instructional assistant position with an elementary in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And I pulled a Newman in that they called me. I was at work with my nanny position. I'm like, hi, yeah, this is blah, blah, blah from blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, what? They're like, oh, you know, for this position? I'm like, yeah, sure, okay. I don't remember applying for this. Didn't say that.
Oh, no.
There comes a point when you start looking for jobs where you just stop caring where you apply and you just send them all out. And so,
well, it's not even that. I don't remember applying, like, because I just sent out a bunch of applications on the district application system. And also, the school districts are nice around here. They tell you when they don't want you, which is so valuable.
Yeah,
like getting rejected is so nice.
That's one thing I feel like I will never say. Getting rejected is nice.
You haven't started applying for work and not heard back from 90% of the companies you applied for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
Sometimes it's good to just know.
Yeah. So I went into the interview, and I'm, like, talking to them, blah, 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 blah. And the question came up, like, well, so how would you execute your duties on this job? And I had gone back and, like, read the application. So I kind of remembered what I had applied for, but I didn't really, like, I skimmed it. I didn't pay attention to it. So I had to, like, BS my way through the duties part of the job.
Fake it till you make it.
Which was, thankfully, it's fairly similar to a lot of the after-school program work. An instructional assistant is just a TA. It's a teacher's assistant.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, oh, I can fake it. But it was one of those things where I was like, oh, crap. Hopefully they like me. Hopefully they didn't tell. They couldn't tell that I didn't know what I was talking about for a few questions.
Newman, how many phone interviews have you done?
A lot.
Are they, like, hard or, like, do you like them or what? Because I have a feeling that's what I'm going to start to need, like, that's what I'm going to end up doing is because I'm here applying for jobs back home.
So it depends what type of phone interview you're talking about. So since I'm a developer, there's kind of limited on what I can do over a phone interview. So normally, I guess this is going all careery. So normally when I apply for a job, I send out an application. If I somehow manage to get a response back, it's normally someone from HR. They ask me a bit about what I'm looking for in a company, like a bit about me, but it's nothing really too intense. It's more of just make sure that you're a sane, competent person. And I don't think I've ever been rejected after an HR screen. And then for me, I move on to usually a technical screen where they'll ask me, because for me in my field, it's about 3 interviews. So after that's on the technical phone screen where they ask me a bit about my technical background, some basic kind of like exam technical questions, but they really can't test you, you know, for your coding ability.
Mm-hmm.
So after that, it's invited on for a on-site, and usually 3's the end where it can be anyone from just sitting in a room to having 5 or 6 different people come in and out throughout the day asking you different questions. It's a mix of the HR, find out how you are as a human, versus technical where they'll just ask you to code on a whiteboard or a computer right in front of them. So that's, but then again, that's technical. Yeah. And computer science interviewing is so corrupted and such bullshit. So I imagine it's completely different for other fields. It's not, every time I start looking for a new job, I really hate my field just because of, there's a lot of politics involved and a lot of interviewers will ask you questions that are ridiculously hard. And they aren't even looking for an answer. They're trying to just stroke their own egos like, oh, you don't know this? Well, yeah. I know this. Here's the answer.
Yeah.
Plus there's this whole thing of if you don't live, breathe, and die code, then you somehow don't care. There's a lot of that notion going on in computer science where, mm-hmm. like, I go to work, I code for 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, and when I come home, the last thing I want to do is code. That's what I've done for about 40 hours a week. Like, I'd rather, you know, play sports, play video games, watch TV. But unfortunately, there are people that will work 40 hours a week, go home, and they have about 7 other projects they're working on that are all the next Facebook and Amazon.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you send out applications, they're obviously going to take the guy that lives and breathes it versus someone that just enjoys doing it and is fairly good at it but doesn't live and breathe it. So I've actually started working on some side projects trying to boost my resume.
Good.
That's frustrating because I'm not a programmer. I'm a game designer, and I work closely with programmers. But I have started taking computer science classes so that I can work better with them and be a better designer.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But in my experience, like, I code for however many hours on a project. After that, my brain just shuts down. Like, past a certain point, I'm done coding. Like, and see, I just have to stop and walk away. And so the idea that, like, you've got to want to do it during work, before work, and after work is just like, ugh.
Yeah. Even talking about code makes my brain turn off.
That's part of the reason why.
About anything.
Part of the reason I sleep so much is because a lot of it is sitting there critically thinking, like, hard and problem solving, and it just mentally exhausts you.
Yeah.
That's what I tell myself.
Exhausting. It's completely exhausting.
There's other things with you, too, when you're sleeping. But for me, like, for the education field and all the after-school work I've done, even I get phone interviews, and a lot of the time they're like, look, do we like you enough? like, you know, like Ryan said, the phone interview is almost always, are you a sane human being? Okay, good. And then with the education field, it's a lot of, like, come in. We want to make sure you're personable in person. And then after school work, too, they do a lot of, like, right, well, you're going to lead the rest of the interview group in a activity.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to see you do your job.
Yeah. I'm worried about me because it's like I can't come in for an interview because I'm states away. So
a lot of companies, especially for HR stuff, will do Skype interviews.
I want to do that.
I've had a couple Skype interviews. Actually, one of my worst interviews was over a Skype interview. So it was a final round interview, and so this guy schedules to have a Skype conversation with me. And I think this company is over in Virginia. I'm like, cool, like, I can do that. So I get up, like, put on a nice shirt, and I set up my computer for a Skype interview, and he calls me on the phone. And, like, we get connected on Skype, and then all of a sudden he pops up, immediately disables his camera and mutes his microphone. But I'd already hung up the phone at that point because, you know, we were talking via Skype, and he called me back. I was having a Skype interview, not seeing the other person, not being able to hear the other person, and talking to him on the phone.
And he
He just wanted to see me. What was the point of having a Skype interview? Like,
that's weird.
Yeah. Just to monitor your facial expressions.
The low tech level, like certain parts of the high tech industries get to, where they're like, I don't understand Skype, but I still work in a high tech industry. All right, I'm gonna do this Audible read, and then we're gonna.
Do we have a sponsor?
We do have a sponsor.
Holy shit!
For you, the listeners of Podcast Lost in Space, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. I was a huge naysayer about audiobooks for a long time, and then I drove from Calgary to Vancouver, and I bought an audiobook because I just didn't want to listen to podcasts, and I have kind of like, and then I bought all the audiobooks in the series because I have a problem, and I really like Audible. The book I want to recommend it to people is Lies of Locke Lamora. It's a great little, it's a kind of a con man, a fantasy like heist book. They're basically just con men. And the reading, it's like read in a really interesting, each character has a distinct voice. They did a really good job with it. But yeah, if you go to audibletrial.com/plis, P-L-I-S, you'll be able to help out the show and get a free audiobook, which is a pretty good deal.
Oh, that's good to know.
There's the copy. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/plis. Again, that's audibletrial.com/plis for your free audiobook. But yeah.
Oh, Alyssa left.
Yeah, her internet's wonky.
That's good to know because I've been wanting to grab Elon Musk's autobiography.
Yeah.
So
another one is Felicia Day's autobiography. She reads it. And if you ever want to get like a sense of just how crushing her anxiety is and some of the stuff she talks about, she does. She puts that in. Like, you can tell she's going back to some of those stories, which is super interesting. But yeah, that's that. Thanks, Audible, for sponsoring us, or you know, letting us sponsor ourselves with you. Alyssa will be back in a bit. So we're going to quickly touch on, have you heard about this, Emmett? The iPhone from the San Bernardino terror attack?
Yeah.
For anybody else, the iPhone from the San Bernardino terror attack from 2015 was taken by the FBI, but it's encrypted using Apple's encryption. And the FBI now has a court order, but they were demanding Apple break the encryption so they can get evidence off the phone. And Apple, in a very well-worded, or Tim Cook, in a very well-worded open letter, told him to go to hell, essentially. And I'm curious. Well, really, he did.
Told him to go to hell, not in so many words, using a lot of phrases like, we really support and believe in the FBI and know they're trying to do the right thing.
but also we're not going to do this for you.
Yeah.
Have you guys been following up with the updates?
Not as much.
There was just an update today. So it came out that after the phone ended up in the hands of the FBI, the terrorist's Apple ID password was changed. So Apple ID is kind of like your Google account, where everything is backed up to the cloud. And so what came out today was that it was a company phone. It was just like for whatever job he went and shot all those people at. They seized the phone, and then they told the IT administrator for the company to change his Apple ID password and turn off iCloud syncing. So basically everything they want, all these text messages, all his...
is all completely locked in the phone.
It's now locked in the phone because the FBI went to the IT administrator and said, change his password and turn off iCloud sync.
Why did they do that?
So what this is starting to look at is this isn't an issue of they want what's on their phone. Is in their demands, they said they want a back door. So it's starting to look at they're using this awful situation, awful case, as a way for them to get a back door to any iPhone.
Thoughts? Melissa?
I have zero clue as to what you guys are talking about.
You missed the introduction, didn't you?
Yeah, my Wi-Fi died. I didn't have Wi-Fi for like 3 minutes.
All right, pay attention for a second.
I don't even think I know what you're talking about because I don't have...
It'll make sense in a second.
I'm sure you've heard about it.
She doesn't watch the news very much. Emmett, what did you think?
I don't have news. I don't have cable.
You have an internet.
I don't have... Yes, I go on my free time and watch the news online.
Let Emmett talk!
Oh, I didn't even say. I don't know. As somebody who is not a tech expert, I don't really feel like I don't necessarily know that I grasp what the ramifications of a backdoor of that type are, and what type of security exploits that would enable. I kind of only have Apple's word for it, and as much as I think their going public was a very smart move. It also was a move that made them look really good.
So
I don't know. I'm a little torn on that.
So fundamentally, a backdoor that lets it so that, you know, you can encrypt your iPhone, make it so that nobody else can see the data except then the government has a way to see it, means the government has the ability to access any of your personal data. In theory, whenever they want. You know, they say it's just for this special case because there was a, you know. But once that kind of, once you make a backdoor into a secure software, you can't close it again. Not very easily. And so, from the techie side, I think me and Ryan are on the same page, which is, I do not want to give the government the option to basically, you know, it's break into the safe that's in my, you know, access any of my, I don't want to give up that security I have of keeping my information private for the sake of security in a kind of more the government decides what security is way.
So I don't know if you're familiar with an iPhone. I'm sure you are, but the 4 to 6 like PIN number to unlock it, they can't break. And I guess after there's a setting where after 10 times, if you enter it incorrectly 10 times, it will wipe the entire phone, and then this whole point's for not. So, what I understood from Tim Cook's letter was, if there was a way where Apple could somehow, like, if for some reason they had the PIN code backed up to their servers, they would have handed it over to the FBI. Just, here's the code to get in. But the fact is, they don't. Like, that's a huge security flaw right there. Mm-hmm. So the only way for them to get into, or what the FBI is asking, is they want a brand new version of iOS installed on this phone specifically for to bypass the PIN code.
Mm. It basically it makes it so they can brute force the PIN code without worrying about destroying the phone.
Right.
But a full new version of iOS will have to be made and released and updated. And the moment you do that, the moment that exists, that is so dangerous because there is nothing stopping it from the government putting this on other people's phones that, because it's the government and the FBI, they're just shitty. There's nothing stopping it and be like, oh, you're doing suspicious things. We're just going to break into your phone.
And I mean, at this point, from it leaking,
in this day and age.
Or, yeah, leaking to the
yeah,
web.
Yeah, that too.
Hitting the internet, right?
I don't know which I would worry about more, the government or Anonymous, frankly, having that power.
One yeah, can't put
so,
you in jail.
And then, that's true.
Yeah.
But the other, they could publicly humiliate you, though.
Yeah,
the other one
can,
is more, slightly more prone to mob violence.
Yeah, that's true.
And well, it's not that it's not doable.
Speak.
No, well, sorry, I keep muting myself. Yeah, no, I still have zero clue.
Basically, is it this? You boil it down to, would you rather the government have a way to access a terrorist's phone for information, but that means they have access to your phone if they decide to, or would you rather we don't get that information, but you maintain your own personal computer security?
So national security over personal security?
Yeah, essentially.
I mean, I don't want there to be war in my own country. I don't know. That is hard.
Yeah, it is. It's an interesting question.
And it is I think it's a particularly extreme example because it's literally, you know,
a terrorist attack.
Versus apparently a thing that can't be done in one case. It has to be done in every case.
Yeah.
So it is.
I would choose to believe or hopefully be positive and say, oh, they won't use it against all of us, but the government.
Absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Yep.
And then the founder of McAfee came out a couple days ago and said he will, like, pay millions of dollars for, like, the best hackers in the world to do that. And, like, if they can break in another way,
yeah,
that's I'm okay with it. Mm-hmm. Because of the fact it's not a master key.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if they break in, the founder of McAfee is batshit insane and has been proven crazy on multiple occasions. So I also don't want him to have that
software
power. Yeah.
But it's super interesting. Like, there's an interesting divide, which is honestly hacked. Like, if the encryption's honestly hacked by somebody figuring out a way, everybody's like, yeah, that's okay. Apple needs to fix it for everybody else, but yeah, that's okay. Whereas if the government's like, you need to give us the master key, people are like, no, that's not okay.
Yeah. Yeah, the means of how it does it. But, like, I get it's privacy or whatever, but who cares if what's on my phone gets out to the government? I don't
have
anything.
Sure, but do it this way instead. It's the airport security scans that let them see a mildly naked picture of yourself. Of you. You know, are you comfortable with that as a, you're giving up personal liberty secure and personal, like, privacy security for the sake of national security? This problem can be, like, you can talk about it in a lot of places. Like,
yeah,
why couldn't the government monitor your internet traffic to make sure that, you know, you're not hitting extremist sites?
I thought they did do that.
Well, I mean, they do, but it's
they
not
do.
It's illegal. Like, when they get caught, people, you know, lose their jobs for, like, 2 weeks. But technically speaking, it's illegal. Especially since the Patriot Act more or less expired recently.
Well, and there's always something to be said, I think, for that having that kind of trust requires that you believe your principles are 100% in line with the people who have that power. Mm-hmm. I think that's the part where I have concerns, because historically that power has not always been used in incredibly egalitarian ways, necessarily. Yeah.
And I'm going to use this to segue into something that's going to confuse Alyssa pretty easily. But
that tends to be the theme of the day.
Very recently, so cool. The Pokemon Company, Nintendo, the people who make Pokemon, have started using the copyright system to... I mean, they go after fan projects. So people who are like, well, look, you're never going to make a Pokemon MMO, you know, for us to all play Pokemon together. Massively multiplayer online game.
Pokemon World of Warcraft.
You're never going to make it.
That would be so cool.
Right? But they're like, Pokemon's never going to do it. The Pokemon Company's just, so we're going to make it ourselves. And then the Pokemon comes along and goes, yeah, that's illegal, and even though you're not selling it, even though you're not making money from it, that's illegal, you need to stop or we're going to sue you. And just recently they took down a YouTube channel, Pokemon Reorchestrated, which was...
Really?
Yeah.
Who? No.
It's a guy who makes Pokemon covers, like covers of Pokemon music.
He's a close personal friend, actually. I'm sorry.
And he legally licensed the rights to make covers of the music and sell it. Like, he went through the legal channels to do it, and they recently just took down his site, his channel, for, you know, hey, that's our property. Just recently, last year, they threatened to sue a group of just, you know, 20-somethings who were throwing a Pokemon party. Like, an unofficial Pokemon party at PAX.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, yeah, like, we're going to sue you for, like, $10,000 or, like, $100,000 in damages. And the kids got, like, 30 RSVPs. You know? And they're like, we don't have that kind of money.
Mm-hmm.
Why would they be doing that?
So... they are like Disney. Nintendo and Disney are very similar. They're very protective of their intellectual property, and they're very hostile to anybody using it. It's the reason why copyright lasts 120 years instead of the 20 it's supposed to last, is because Disney doesn't want Mickey Mouse to be public domain, because people are just going to make porn with Mickey Mouse. And Disney is very protective of that idea. So they've actually forced a lot of change over the years.
It's like Mickey Mouse's image. But why would a Pokemon party be...
Because it used their imagery?
But that's just confusing.
So yes, this is where we're getting to, which is a lot of this stuff happens in a legal gray area. Parody is legal and protected, even though companies don't seem to remember this.
Dumb Starbucks. I don't know if you guys heard about that.
Yeah, like, stupid Starbucks is a legal thing, as long as he doesn't use the exact replica of the logo.
Yeah, you have to change it a little.
Journalists, you know, journalism stuff is protected. Theoretically, works that build off the previous work, like change it, are protected. But a lot of the time, they're, you know, companies go after them anyway.
Like, we couldn't, in culinary school and stuff, we couldn't, like, draw or, like, decorate a cake and do, like, Olaf or Mickey Mouse or whatever and sell it.
Right.
We either had to buy, like, the sugar paper sheets that are, already, like, made by Disney and, like, do that and because we're buying it from them and then you can sell it. But, like... we couldn't sell anything if it was in the shape of Mickey. And I don't know how companies do it entirely, because I know, like, some cake decorators do, but I know, like, we couldn't because we don't have any rights to
you
sell.
You don't have the licenses.
The licenses and stuff.
And go ahead.
Some of it is there's a right to protect your copyright in terms of, like, if I were to do this and a fan work already existed which had done this, for example, I think the Pokemon MMO would be an example. Sure, they have no plans to do that right now, but if they eventually wanted to make a Pokemon MMO and a fan one that was really popular already existed, they would theoretically lose a lot of money from that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of the stuff using the image goes into the same thing. Where it gets really weird is when you get to, like, the Pokemon party, where it's kind of like,
yeah,
would you have lost money on that? Like,
would you have lost $100,000 that you...
Yeah, and certainly, like, can you make that claim legitimately that those are the damages you would suffer from that?
Yeah.
And not only that, they immediately went to, we're suing you, instead of, we sent you a cease and desist. And the kid was like, if you had sent me a cease and desist, we would have stopped.
Yeah.
Like, but, like, I don't understand what the big... like, people have, like, Tinkerbell parties and...
Oh, yeah. But if, like, it's... private consumption is different from a public event.
What?
If you do it for yourself and your friends, they can't do anything to stop you.
Mm-hmm.
Yet.
Oh, so they, like, put it out there on, like...
But this was, like, a public event where they're like, hey, yeah, you guys like Pokemon, we like Pokemon, come to our party.
Yeah, they made it a public... It's like, you know, you can show a film to as many of your friends as you want in your living room, but if you want to put on a screening, you have to license it.
Which is ironic, because you could have more friends come over to your house than people show up at a movie theater.
Yeah, but definitely.
But the moment you make it public, no matter how widespread it gets, it's, I think companies freak out too much, or their sticks are so far up their ass that they have to show their dominance, I guess.
There are a lot of companies that are legally obligated. Like, the way copyright works, you have to sue literally everybody who uses your trademark. Or if somebody, you know, starts using your trademark and sells it, and starts making money, and you go to sue them, but you didn't sue the guy, you know, who was making Pokemon mugs, you know, for his friends, and maybe selling a few on the side. You didn't sue him. There's a legal precedent that the people who are, like, making billions can get away with stealing your trademark. It happened to Lovecraft. Famously, the Lovecraftian horror kind of thing. He didn't really... him and his estate didn't really protect...
What was it based
on? No, it was him.
Oh.
Didn't really protect the kind of that IP in the way that Disney did, or, you know, other companies have done. And it became its own genre. And so now that estate can't go back and claim all those things as its own.
Yeah. What is Lovecraft?
It's a... from the early 20th century horror writer.
Yeah.
He invented Cthulhu and a lot of other kind of horror characters, and then they essentially became public domain, so they can be used by anyone because he was notoriously lax about defending his copyright.
Yeah.
That's surprising.
And, you know, it hurt him in a lot of ways, but also it spawned... it also spawned a beautiful, like, sub-genre of horror.
Mm-hmm.
And then, on the flip, like... And I'm shitting on Nintendo right now because they were the ones who did it the most recently, but a lot of other companies do this, especially in the games industry. But then you get a lot of other places, like J.K. Rowling has famously been like, look, if you start selling, like, fan fiction in my world, you know, stuff that you're writing in my world, I'm going to have to sue you or tell you to stop. But she's not going to really target there's an entire, like, trilogy that a novelist wrote about Harry's dad. But he's, you know, he put it up for free. He's not asking for money. He kind of just did it. And Rowling kind of acknowledges it and goes, yeah, okay, that's fine.
And I would have to double check this, but I know there have been legal precedents recently that have made selling fan fiction more allowable legally.
Oh, interesting.
If anyone wants to check it out, the Organization for Transformative Works would have information about that. They run the Archive of Our Own, which is a big fan fiction archive. Fan art has always kind of existed in a gray space where, if you go to any sci-fi or fantasy convention or anything, any gaming convention, you will find artists selling fan art of, you know, licensed copyright.
Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, you'll find fan work being sold there. That's historically been fan art, and fan fiction, for various reasons, was in a more of a, like, unallowable zone, but I know that recently, legally, it has become more acceptable, at least. I know of folks who, you know, might have a Patreon set up for works that they're creating with copyrighted characters. They seem to be legally allowed to do that.
Yeah, it's an issue, like, because you get somebody who goes, I want you to make me a really interesting Pikachu. Mm-hmm. And as an artist, you can do that. Like, if they pay you money, you can totally get away with that, even though you're technically using copyright material.
Like tattoos.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How does that work? Yeah. Tattoo artists have, like, license to do that kind of stuff, or
it's
do they
a
just
really
get away
weird gray
it?
Area in copyright?
Yeah.
That is, and
people get tattoos of, like, Pikachu.
Mm-hmm.
And it is
Mario.
Somewhat protected by the, what was it? Oh god, what is it called? What's the word? It's the thing that protects, like, journalist stuff.
Oh. I don't know what it's called, but I know what you're talking about.
Why would I forget that? But essentially it's somewhat protected by, like, there's some legal precedent protecting things like that.
You know anthropologists aren't protected by that? The
what
writing?
Do you mean?
So, like, you know how, like, journalists and stuff, they can't get, like, what is it called?
What?
They can't get sent to, like, testify or anything. Journalism's, like, they don't, but anthropologists can. They're not protected by the First Amendment, right? That'd be,
That's interesting.
Yeah, found that out.
Did not know that.
So, what's interesting, too, is this Nintendo news especially just hit about the day after Valve greenlit two different games made by their fans based in their Half-Life world for sale. So, you know, modding and like, modding is basically people using game engines that exist to make other games or make things within a game.
Mm-hmm.
And so these two fans made a spin-off of, like, just a side story in the Half-Life world, and the other one remade Half-Life in a more modern compute programming engine, and Valve gave both of them permission to sell it. I mean, one's like $10 and the other one's like $2.
Well, that's the only way we're going to get something close to Half-Life 3.
Well,
because if someone else makes it.
But it's interesting because that's a company who literally has almost more power than Nintendo.
Mm-hmm.
That is like, okay, we're okay with that. Cool, go ahead. Well, we'll even let you sell it. You didn't touch, like, the main canon, so we don't really care. Go ahead.
Well, and it's really interesting because I feel like there's always a spate of double standards as far as what gets shut down and what actually gets validated by the creators.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it comes down to the individual creator, but stuff like, I've been looking into community management work in the games industry, and one of the things you'll find if you look up ways to prep for doing that is you should engage as a fan. And I've seen panels where folks who work at these companies have been saying, like, we rely on fan wikis. We love people who organize meetups, who go out there and do that, and who create their own videos on YouTube, have really successful YouTube channels that pull from their games. People who create fan music, people who, like, there's a group of parkour artists who make videos around the Assassin's Creed games.
Yep.
And they are officially partnered with Ubisoft to make some of those videos now because they kept making them, and Ubisoft saw that and was like, this is awesome.
Well, yeah.
All of those cases. And it's then, like, you have, like, fan fiction and fan art where it's like, oh, no, we don't want you to do that.
Yeah, I mean, it's Rooster Teeth making Red versus Blue.
Yeah.
In Halo, in the Halo engine. And they're actually, what was interesting with that was for a while, Microsoft gave everybody kind of blanket slate. And about, what, like 08 or something, they pared it down and they went, like, these five, like, series that are still doing their thing, we're cool with you. Everybody else needs to stop.
Oh, interesting.
It's smart, though, for companies to do what you were talking about, is that, like, pair up with those Assassin's Creed people, because that's a smart PR move, because you're showing we support, we appreciate the fans, and two, they already have this big following, and just to attach your name onto it, it just gets you more out there.
So, yeah, and being in the games industry, we see this a lot with the YouTube communities.
Mm-hmm.
Because the old games journalist side of it is kind of cemented. They're protected. They're a journalist's center. But you see it a lot with YouTube communities where, like, Nintendo literally kills everything that has their name on it.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you do a report with Nintendo and you play, like, 2 seconds of their game footage so people know that it's Nintendo, like, what you're talking about, Nintendo will strike you.
Yeah.
Which is outright illegal.
But then now, like, gamers and stuff have this, like, Nintendo's evil mindset, not Nintendo loves us mindset.
Right, exactly.
Yes.
I think that's stupid PR on Nintendo's side.
Yeah, and you get a lot of the more American companies who are like, yeah, go ahead. You know, a lot of, especially, was it EA a few years ago? Or Activision, who kind of said, like, we don't want any of this stuff. And then all of the all of the indie devs are like, we'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, go ahead and do our video. Go ahead and play our game, because you're giving us exposure. Please.
Yeah.
Like, if AAA are being stupid, we want that.
It should be, I would think these big companies, as long as, like, yeah, you have to walk on that line of, like, you're not directly copying the characters and stuff, but, like, they should be encouraging creativity and encouraging the next generation, you know, and the next group of people, because this, like, gaming industry is blowing up.
Just reserved to games, but, like, I'm just really
general, I think people should be encouraged and companies should be doing that, because especially if they do have a solid base, and yeah, you do have to walk the line of, like, legality, but yeah.
And we could keep going, probably, especially me and Emmett, could keep going forever, but we're hitting our hour. Emmett, do you have...
I did want to bring up one thing. When you mentioned Valve and they greenlit two games within their genre, one of their biggest successes, arguably, was Dota, which was a fan-made mod, which then they took and hired them on, so... Like, honestly, Valve has had great success before Dota, but I would say, arguably, that's been their most successful franchise, even to this day, with how large that community is.
And that wasn't even a mod in their own game. It was a mod in a Blizzard Entertainment game.
Yeah, it was a Warcraft mod.
It was a Warcraft 3 mod. And what was interesting was they had a legal meeting, Blizzard and everybody's like, oh, they're going to start fighting. And they went, look, we're not going to sue our fans who keep playing the Dota mod. And Blizzard and Valve went, no. They're like, all right, we won't sue you either. They kind of just went, cool, the fans are protected, we don't need to worry about it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess, Emmett, final thoughts really quick, and then we'll hit the kind of the end of the show wrap up.
Yeah, I mean, I am just very pro. I mean, I totally understand that there are legal ramifications and companies need to protect their own, but I also think that there's a lot of fan engagement that comes from pure enjoyment of the product that you've made, and that there's an incredible amount of creative work that gets poured into that into all kinds, and I think that creators need to check themselves when they come down on even fan works that they don't necessarily understand. Like, you see, I think people come down harder on fan fiction because it is a particular part of fandom that's historically dominated by women and queer people, and it tends to be less understandable to creators, and it tends to get the hammer put down on it harder. And I think then if creators actually dug into what's going on there, they would see a huge, like, upwelling ecosystem of creative energy and huge amounts of engagement with their product that they could better channel into actually respecting that fan engagement with their product. So I don't know.
Cool. Ryan, any other thoughts?
No.
Okay. The big one for me is, I think all art is inherently authorial? The author, once you put your piece out into the world, you have lost control over how people engage with it. So for me, like, there's a certain, yeah, okay, make sure people aren't selling stuff based, like, that's literally like, we're Harry Potter, but we're not, you know. Protect yourself so you can make money, because you need to eat. Like, you need to feed yourself, or Nintendo needs to pay its employees, you know. There's a certain, but I think just about every kind of form of fan art is inherently transformative, or fan fiction or YouTube stuff is inherently, it changes the story. And this is me as a writer, like, thinking about what would happen if my book got big and people started writing all sorts of weird smut and crossfic, you know, and like just things for me that I'm like, I don't want to touch that.
I pray every day that that happens to my work. Like, I would be delighted.
It's a sign of ultimate respect that somebody loves your characters and loves your world enough to want to invest their own creative energy into your thing. It's a kind of a weird thing, but also, in the end, the U.S. copyright system is fundamentally broken, and it rewards large corporations and doesn't protect small people making a living. Like, almost all Christian fiction is literally Bible fan fiction. But the church, if it was more if it was more like the analog to the Nintendo Corporation, could in theory just destroy that entire genre. If you could claim if the church could claim copyright on that thing, on the Bible, which is an extreme example, but it's a thing.
That would be an amazing legal battle to witness.
Beautiful. And honestly, the precedents it would set would actually probably help a lot of us. But yeah, so then, real quick, Alyss, where can they find you?
Check out my website, which I really got to update. AlyssaP.com. I'm going to shout out my Instagram because I want more followers, but it's Alyssa Pereira, AlyssaSSA, P like Paul, EREIRA, 21. Check out my Instagram.
Cool.
Follow me.
Emmett, where can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Emmett Scout, EMMETT, Scout like a Boy Scout. And you can find the work that my studio does at the digitalfuturelab.com.
Perfect. Ryan, do you have a MySpace or anything weird to
bring to the show? I have a GitHub now that I'm actually working on some stuff.
Actually, you have stuff.
You can...
give me your code repositories.
My current project is I'm working on an open source voting simulator for this upcoming 2016 election, just because I think it's crazy that we still use punch cards. So I'm just going to create an open source so people know there's no corruption going on in the back end and... hopefully get a job. That's currently what's up there. You can find that at github.com/Newman29.
Nice.
Feel free to take a look at that. Give me any critiques. Just give me one view on my profile would be great.
The voice to code project is coming later this year.
Yeah.
We'll make Ryan slave away on that. And then I'm Alexander. You can find me at Redbeard on Twitter, REDBREARD. Look, if you look anywhere, I'm one of the only people stupid enough to misspell Redbeard in that way. So if you look at, just find me on just about any social media that way. If you can't find it there, add a 242. Odds are you found me again, because sometimes I make both the accounts because I'm stupid. If you can find my writer's page on Amazon, or you can find my Facebook page, my writer Facebook page, follow it. I should probably update it again at some point. I promise I might. Follow us at podcastlostinspace.com. We're on iTunes.
That's you.
Leave us a comment on iTunes. Leave us an iTunes review. We love it when we get those. Follow us at Pliss Official. Blah, 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 blah. You've heard it every week. It'll all be
share,
in the...
Share our stuff on Facebook.
Share our stuff on Facebook.
Money through Audible.
Yes, please visit the audibletrial.com/Audible. And give us some money so that we can buy... the first thing we're going to do is buy Doc a camera.
Yeah, that's important.
But yeah, do that. Thanks for watching.
Bye.